Hello, my name is Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I blog at foreignpolicy.com and am the author of Theories of International Politics and Zombies.
And I'm Daniel Levy. I'm Direct Middle East Task Force here at the New America Foundation, also a co-editor at the Middle East Channel at foreignpolicy.com. Do you want to kick us off, Dan?
Well, sure. First, let me say it's a pleasure to talk to you. We've never met, but I certainly have read your work. This might be cruel, but I always think of you when I went through. I heard a joke about the Israeli left that makes me always think of you. When I was in Israel last summer, I met someone else who was also in the Israeli left, and he said the joke was that you know, he was going to this panel and you know, talking about Israeli views of security, and someone in the audience stands up and complains that, you know, he's only been hearing from people from Likud and other sort of conservative factions, where, you know, where is the Israeli left? And the guy who's representing them at the panel says, "I don't understand what you're complaining about. Both of us are here." But you're certainly one of the two, so that's important to you can give a good voice on this.
The sad truth of the shifting of the center of gravity in Israel so dramatically to the right, I think, is very much part of the story that we're in. But please,
right? No, and I think that's certainly something we should talk about. So, I mean, to kick off our conversation of the dams on the Middle East,
yes,
there was a little bit of excitement over the weekend, as Syria apparently decided to allow Palestinians to enter the Golan Heights as part of a commemoration of the Nakba, which is the expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland after the 1948 recognition of both Israel and Palestine. And I believe IDF forces shot four people. Is that correct?
I think the numbers, if one combines the Syrian and Lebanese border, was 16, and I think you're right. On the Syrian element, it was four.
Right. And, you know, this has obviously caused a fair amount of gnashing of teeth across the Middle East as well as within Washington, because rather remarkably, most of what's happened over the Arab Spring, you know, while touching a little bit on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, has not really been all that much about the Palestinians. And this is one of those events that potentially threatens to put this issue front and center again. And as Andrew Exum has blogged repeatedly, you know, governments in the region are relatively cynical about this and are perfectly happy to push the Palestinian cause as a way of distracting discontent at home. This was certainly the practice of authoritarian governments across the region, and one could argue that this was being done by Bashar Assad's government because it's been under intense domestic pressure from domestic protests. I guess, you know, what are your thoughts about how this is going to play out in terms of the region, and whether this is just one of, you know, a beginning of provocations potentially by the Assad government as a way to distract attention from their own domestic problems?
I think that argument would be a lot more compelling were it not for the fact that this was happening in Jordan, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, the West Bank, Gaza, and inside Israel. In other words, the entire Palestinian refugee community in and around Israel, the territories, the immediate region, chose this as a day to... I mean, some have called this the Palestinians joining the Arab Spring, so to speak. But it was happening everywhere, in Jordan, yeah, and Egypt. The security forces there did try to prevent and succeeded in preventing Palestinian protesters and Palestinian sympathizers from reaching Israel's border. In the West Bank and in Gaza,
didn't they also try to attack the Israeli embassy in Cairo?
Well, there was a protest outside the Israeli embassy, right, in Cairo. I don't know whether it was an attempted attack. It was.
No, I think there was tear. This is one of those Twitter things that I'm not sure is true or not, but I think tear gas was fired at that protest.
Right. So I mean, the protesters were in some way attacked by the security forces. I don't know whether the protesters were themselves trying to breach the outer perimeter of the embassy. I just don't have that,
okay,
information. So I don't think one can say that this was a card being played here by the Syrian authorities. I think it's perfectly reasonable to conjecture that whereas in the past the Syrian authorities would have prevented protesters from reaching the border, this time they perhaps saw an interest in letting this happen, perhaps even encouraging it. But I think the point is that, that the encouragement wasn't needed. This is going on everywhere in the region.
Well, hold on. I mean, just to push back a little bit on this, I'm not doubting that you might be right, but the one thing that strikes me is that it's not like the Syrian government is the only government that has an incentive to distract attention from domestic issues. I mean, you could argue that the other governments you listed, you know, Jordan in particular, and for that matter, the West Bank, would also have an incentive to, you know, target ire against Israel rather than their own leaderships.
Well, but the Jordanians did precisely the opposite. The Jordanians prevented the protesters from reaching the border, and there were...
Oh, I see. So you're saying that what's unique about the Syrian situation is that the Syrians were the only ones to actually allow them to get to the border. The other governments actually did prevent it from happening.
Right. And I don't think...
Okay.
I don't think if you're nominally running the small parts of the West Bank that are in Palestinian Authority partial control, you really have to be inciting your people to be unhappy about the Israeli presence. But yeah, I mean, what the difference in Syria to other places and to the past was that there was less government intervention to prevent this from happening. And, you know, to be honest, I don't think this has changed the conversation in Syria. I think this was more to the extent to which there was a Syrian unique component to this, and I think it's a reasonable thing to suggest. It was more about sending a signal perhaps to Israel and to America by the Assad regime, hey guys, remember how we've kept this border quiet for 30 plus years? If you don't want there to be a central governing authority which really runs things in Syria and us running things in Syria, this is what you might expect to be coming down the pipeline. Which is a message that was, I mean, one already has the sense that the official Israeli side was not exactly full of enthusiasm for revolution in Syria, just as they weren't enthusiastic about revolution in Egypt.
Revolution in Egypt sounds strange, right.
Because, of course, Egypt, the Mubarak regime, was a partner for Israel in whatever Israel was trying to do. The Assad regime was not, but I think the common strand was that both would, as you say, cynically use the Palestinian issue, prevent Israel having to go out of its comfort zone on this issue because they themselves didn't want to go out of their comfort zone on this issue.
Right. I mean, I guess the you're right. I think the Israeli position on what's happened in the Middle East is basically they always prefer the devils they know to the devils they don't. I think the question is, first of all, I mean, do you think this is a successful signal by the Assad regime? I mean, this could be one of those things that plays both ways. It could be that, yes, the signal sent to the Israelis is, look, you know, you don't interfere because, you know, things could get a lot worse. On the other hand, the other signal this could be sending would be, I'm desperate enough to actually allow Palestinians to go to the border, which means that my regime is much more fragile than you think. Which I would imagine if I was the Israeli security establishment, I would start wanting to think about backup scenarios and contingency plans.
I think you're absolutely right in terms of the contingency plans. I think that the way things play out in Syria will largely be determined in Syria, not in Jerusalem and not in Washington, D.C.
What about Turkey?
I think Turkey will have a greater role. There are neighboring countries. I mean, the point, of course, about Israel and about Washington is they have precious little leverage with events in Syria, with the Assad regime. I think some people have naively said, why did you do X in Egypt? You encouraged the dictator to stand down, but you're not doing in Syria, which is an adversary, not an ex-ally. Why aren't... all the difference in the world, as I'm sure we agree, Dan, in a relationship where you're providing $2 billion a year to a state and you're training its military and you have contacts with those militaries because most of the leaderships have been through your military training academies, yeah, and a country which you've been sanctioning for almost two decades, and you kind of search around what additional sanction can we impose on Syria, and it's not obvious what can be done. But you're right, there are other surrounding countries that have more of a say, Turkey particularly being one of them. My understanding is that they really tried to push the Assad regime. They're thoroughly frustrated in Ankara that there hasn't been movement, and that more and more of the Syrian opposition leadership, exile leadership meetings are apparently going to be taking place in Turkey.
Oh, interesting. No, I have to admit, what's happened in the Middle East has actually been, from a scholarly perspective, a vindication for me. I wrote a book in 1999 called The Sanctions Paradox, on the use of economic sanctions in international relations.
Right, I'm familiar
the basic message of that book is that the paradox is that sanctions work and pressure works much more effectively against allies than adversaries. Yeah. But, of course, sanctioning states are going to be much more eager and willing to sanction adversaries than allies. So as a result, not shockingly, the way this has played out in the Middle East is you've seen pressure work in the case of Egypt. It's not going to work, I agree with you, in the case of Syria. Although I think the comparison that I've seen, you know, in terms of commentary about Syria is not so much the parallel to Egypt, but rather the parallel to Libya, which is to say you have an odious, you know, regime which is, you know, massacring, for lack of a better way of putting it, its own citizens. In the case of Libya, that led to, you know, NATO intervention and a Security Council resolution, whereas it won't do that, obviously, in the case of Syria. I agree with you, by the way, though, that the two situations are very different, which is Gaddafi had the unique situation of being loathed by everyone else in the entire region, which, if you think about it, is a pretty,
it's an unique achievement. Right?
It takes a lot of work to really piss off everyone in that region. Whereas Assad is clearly not in that same category. There are other countries with ties to him. And so if you were to engage in military action against Syria, first, it's not clear it would work because there's no armed opposition yet, although you're starting to read stories about that. But second, you know, there's no way you could do this without Iran getting involved and without it leading to a potentially much more serious conflagration. So I agree with you that the military option is not on the table with respect to Syria. And the economic sort of tool, yeah, you're going to impose sanctions and it'll cost a little bit, but it's not going to be all that serious. I have seen, you know, criticisms out there about why the Obama administration has not been more vocal in criticizing, you know, the Assad regime, at least just rhetorically, because, you know, yeah, if you can't pressure him, at least you could, like, you know, take a principled stand. Do you think the Obama administration should be more forthcoming on this point?
I think they have laid out their expectations and criticisms regarding what's going on in Syria. I think if you're trying to manage this, you probably don't want to create too much of a gap between what you call for and the actual actions you're willing to take to make that happen. And I also think they probably look at this and say, well, you know, we're a little bit susceptible to the hypocrisy charge regarding Bahrain, for instance. But I think...
Oh, yeah, there's total hypocrisy.
Sorry?
Everyone's being hypocritical in this region. I mean, come on, the United States is you know, you're right, you know, they've been perfectly willing to back Egypt, Tunisia, Libya to a lesser extent, but on Bahrain or on Yemen, you know, they've kept their mouth shut, and for strategic reasons. On the other hand, of course, the Iranians have been even more, equally hypocritical on this. You know, praising any, you know, revolution that they think would help them, but, you know, keeping their mouth shut about Syria and, of course, their own country.
And their own country, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I also think the without in any way excusing what the Assad regime has done, I think some people would suggest there's a qualitative difference between what Gaddafi was apparently willing to unleash on his own public and what has happened so far from Assad. I think the administration, and the administration is not alone on this, has real question marks about what they do in Libya too, but I think this comes more to the fore given the immediate neighborhood around Syria, which is what is the democratic as opposed to non-democratic part of the Syrian opposition consisting of? And when I say the neighborhood, I think what you have around Libya is trying to protect the gains of democracy in Tunisia and Egypt. What you have around Syria is Iraq and Lebanon, at least on two of the borders, both of which look a little bit more like Syria in terms of the sectarian makeup, in terms of the nature of ruling elite minorities, and in terms of the huge capacity borne out already in Lebanon and Iraq for state collapse, instability, fitna, as it's known, not something you necessarily want to create across an arc of three countries.
No, that's fair enough. So, I mean, I think we can safely rule out the... you're right that I think Syria is largely going to be solved by Syrians. This does raise a question with respect to Israel, though, which is... remember Israel? I've said this before. I was in the region... I was in Israel for a couple of weeks back in the summer, and, 2010... it was one of those highfalutin tours where we got to meet with senior IDF people and senior people in the government and so forth. And, they would talk security threats. And, the sort of thing that's happening now never came up. Revolution in Egypt, discontent across the Arab world was never an issue that they had even remotely on the radar screen. So, I think it's safe to say that this is... taken Israel by strategic surprise. The question I'm curious about, in terms of your thoughts, is how they responded and has the response evolved over time?
Look, I obviously Israel wasn't alone, Dan, in...
No. I'm not meaning to say how foolish Israel was, whereas everyone else saw it coming.
Right.
At the same time, I have seen Israel... excoriate the U.S. for being surprised by this, when it strikes me that Israel would have an even greater incentive to be aware that this was potentially going to happen. But what I'm wondering is, the initial reaction, as near as I can figure out, has basically been complete and utter distaste and displeasure about it. Do you think there is at least any kind of adaptation in terms of how to cope with these things?
I think there is an adaptation of narrative, but not an adaptation of... practical steps being taken by Israel. I think you're right that the idea that the country that has raised this banner of only democracy in the Middle East for so long would be caught kind of saying, that was an aspiration, it wasn't a lament, with the initial recoil that the Israeli leadership seemed to have in the face of developments in Egypt especially. They realized that that wasn't very smart. And so what I think you have seen already, and you will certainly see when Prime Minister Netanyahu visits Washington in the coming days, you're going to hear him embrace, wrap his arms around democracy, remind everyone of what a mature democracy Israel is, remind everyone of the shared democratic values that Netanyahu would claim America and Israel have. And in so doing, I think he will try and set a bar for what constitutes true entrenchment, establishment, trustworthy democracy in the area surrounding Israel. And so I think in narrative terms, they've got wise. Sadly, I think that this really impacts Israel's geostrategic environment. And in terms of thinking that through, there's still a combination of a rabbit caught in the headlights and a leadership that sees no better alternative for themselves, politically and strategically, than to dig in, to hope maybe that this goes a little pear-shaped, perhaps to hope for instability in the surrounding area, perhaps to be able to suggest that Israel is an oasis of stability, a front line in a clash of civilizations, but not actually to rethink. And I think this really came home to roost on Sunday, how much a rethink is in order with the events of Palestinians from inside, outside, all the surrounding neighbors saying, hey, this freedom march is not going to pass us by. Just how urgent that strategic rethink is. I don't know how you're looking at that, Dan. I'd be interested.
Well, I would say a few things. First, as in terms of the narrative, that's not a... I mean, if I was Netanyahu, I would probably go with that same narrative, because you could make the case from the Israeli perspective to say, look, we are still the only mature democracy in the region, and have you seen how democratic transition is playing out in Egypt right now? It's not playing out terribly well. There are ways in which, you know, there's sectarian violence. You know, you see Copt churches being burned. You know, and furthermore, you know, we know from international relations literature that democratizing states are in some ways the most dangerous and violent states to deal with, because they don't have, you know, cemented institutions to cope with domestic pressure. And as a result, there is often a tendency towards the populist among leaders, which can lead to stupid decisions. So that's not necessarily the worst narrative to offer, particularly, you know, a U.S. perspective, because, you know, again, Egypt is the obvious case to look at. And, you know, the Egypt Road to Democracy, it's I think, probably in some ways going better than a lot of people might have expected in January. But in other ways, you know, there you can point to instances where clearly there is not such a thing as necessarily a mature Egyptian civil society, and therefore to say you've got to put your chips on Israel as well. In terms of the larger strategic question of how Israel copes with this, I mean, it strikes me that the bigger pressure point for Israel is less the region. I mean, because in some ways, I think one of the grand ironies about what's happened strategically is that there are two countries in the region that are really not happy with the United States right now, and they're Israel and Saudi Arabia, which are not countries that are traditionally thought of as being on the same same page in terms of much. There are other geostrategic trends that I think probably benefit Israel, like the GCC extending membership to Jordan or offering Jordan a membership as well as Morocco, the notion that there will be this sort of Sunni bloc, you know, to simultaneously oppose Iran and also impose democracy. So I think there are counter trends. In other words, my advice to Israel would be not to panic, because there are ways in which over the long term they can still potentially keep the narrative they want. Now, that whether or not I want that from a U.S. perspective is something entirely different. But I think the other pressure, and this is something we were going to talk about, that I don't think they've handled terribly well, is this sort of been this stealth campaign, which is now not so stealth, by the Palestinians to acquire statehood. This has been the Palestinian Prime Minister's Salam Fayyad strategy for quite some time, which is the notion that, you know, I don't care about the negotiations, I actually want to build Palestinian state institutions that can function. And now you're starting to see, you know, movement by other countries recognizing Palestine as an independent state, and they're going to go to the General Assembly to try to get that kind of recognition. And this is an arena that hits at Israel's sort of vulnerability, which is its sort of reputation in the international community, and particularly in the United Nations, which is to say not good. And I'm not sure Israel has a response to that. I mean, I'm kind of curious how you think that they can respond to that.
Look, I would agree with one caveat to your narrative on the democracy potential move that Netanyahu will make. I think the concern, certainly that myself and many Israeli friends would share, is Israel's own slippery slope that Israeli democracy is on, which is partly structurally determined by if you're going to maintain this kind of occupation, there are certain things that you bring on yourselves. But it's fascinating.
Wait, can I push you on that? Because I there's two separate issues here, which is the first one, which I agree with you, is the notion that Israel cannot, you know, it becomes increasingly untenable for it to claim it's a democracy as an increasing percentage of its population has no rights whatsoever and is really under occupation. But the other thing that's going on has been over the past decade, you know, to be blunt, a shift in Israeli public opinion towards the right, which, you know, makes it tougher for people like you to articulate a view that's politically popular.
Well, if this were a democratic right, I think it wouldn't touch upon what I've been mentioning. It is a shift to an anti-democratic right, which is, I think, the thing that has many people very scared. It's, you know, Israel kind of never got to grips with how do you marry Jewish with democratic, and increasingly, right, it's one at the expense of the other. and it's the mm-hmm. Jewish at the expense of the Democratic. So there's a whole slew of legislation being considered, and some of it being passed right now in Israel, which is just anti-democratic. There's no other word for it.
Can you give a couple of for instances here?
A couple of for instances, the kind of loyalty oath that would basically be addressed at Palestinians who would seek to become Israeli citizens. The very fact mm-hmm. that a Palestinian in Israel, a full Israeli citizen, uniquely cannot take a spouse from overseas who is a Palestinian and have that spouse then go through the process of being able to become an Israeli citizen. Mm-hmm. The so-called Nakba law, in terms of any institution that receives state funding that in any way commemorates that Palestinian history, would have that state funding withdrawn from it. And that's just the laws that have passed. That's not the laws that are being considered, that are being promoted through the Knesset. And that's not the general kind of atmosphere of the conversation in Israel. So I think the democratic, civil rights, human rights community in Israel, from the very mainstream Israel Democracy Institute to the more ACLU-like ACRI, which is the Israeli equivalent, are all got their kind of red alarm bells flashing over this issue. And you know, that's the really sad part of what you just said about Israel and the Saudis finding themselves unusually in a very similar place. They're both very, at this stage, conservative status quo powers, but you know, someone was writing in the Israeli media some time back, because Israel now has this discovery of natural gas, whether Israel will start looking more like Saudi Arabia in other ways as well, which is not a prospect that I think either of us would welcome.
Although it introduces a wider variety of hats in Israel, which is interesting.
We've got a good hat variety.
You do have a fantastic
you know,
hat
I want to stand up here for Israeli hat pride. Look, on the Palestinian on the Palestinian recognition front, I think in many Palestinian circles, the surprise is less that the leadership is abandoning the negotiation model, which has failed to deliver for 20 years or more, and is pursuing less Israel-dependent, less American-dependent ways of trying to create leverage, of trying to address the asymmetry by going, for instance, to the UN. I think for many the surprise is more that they're sticking to the very two-state model itself, to that 67 division. And you know, from an Israeli two-statist perspective, I think that's actually something to draw encouragement from. Which is mm-hmm. the very move to go to the UN to try and assert 1967 is actually, if you're into the continued existence of the State of Israel, it's probably something to kind of a sigh of relief that this is...
Particularly the Jewish State of Israel.
Well, because it's the 67 lines. Yesterday,
right,
sorry,
exactly.
Not yesterday, yeah. Sunday wasn't about the 67 lines, right?
Right, Sunday was about, Sunday was about 48.
Yeah.
No, so that's fair. And then, you know, Mahmoud Abbas obviously had an op-ed in the New York Times talking about the Palestinian push for statehood, mm-hmm. and I believe he also mentioned the 67 borders.
Well, Khaled Mashal talked about the 67 borders very explicitly when they had their reconciliation ceremony in Cairo, which doesn't mean Hamas has come round to a position that I would be comfortable with, but it means that you now have both of the major Palestinian movements quite unequivocally on the same page vis-a-vis
how long is that? I guess my question is, how long is that going to last? Because, I mean, you know, the one message I got when I was in the region was that the two-state solution is still viable for a few more years, and then after that, the demographics just make it next to impossible or make it increasingly difficult. And what's odd to me is that, you know, across the Israeli security establishment, there's an awareness of this, and yet a complete lack of any sense of how to get from here to there?
I was with a very leading Israeli media commentator and personality a couple of days ago, and she was saying, actually, while kind of democracy seems to be moving nicely in the rest of the Middle East, in Israel, maybe we need a dose of military dictatorship, because the security establishment understands that there are steps we need to take that the politicians seem incapable of taking. Not something I'd necessarily welcome. In fact, I wouldn't welcome it. But I don't know. I think the simple question is, Dan, in 10 years' time, we could look back and say how naive that we were even still thinking about two states in 2011, when you had 500,000 Israelis living beyond the green line and you couldn't even freeze settlements, right, let alone withdraw settlements. And although they'd withdrawn from Gaza in 2005, the lesson from Gaza was no more, not more, etc. Or we could be sitting here 10 years from now and saying, well, you know, just a few years later, a two-state border was actually achieved, and then they went on from that to a deeper process of reconciliation. I don't know. What I found discouraging is that the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, gave a speech at the opening of the Knesset on Monday, which was really the three Israeli no's. And he basically said no to Palestinian sovereignty. The idea that Israelis could stay in the Jordan Valley means there's not going to be a sovereign Palestinian state. No to 67. You know, he said all of Jerusalem. He said the settlement blocks. And no to reconciliation, because while Netanyahu is right that this is not just about 67, it has to be about 48, if you really want to resolve this on the Israeli side and move on to a new page, you are somehow going to have to acknowledge, rather than be in denial and in self-righteous indignation about Nakba. You're going to have to come to terms with that. Now, maybe you can't do all of that at once. But it seems on the Israeli side that a combination.
Daniel, can I put, yeah, what would it mean for the Israelis to come to terms with the Nakba? The one hand, there's no way, there is absolutely no way that there can be a peace deal in which the Israelis acknowledge the right to return, right?
I mean, I agree.
That's a non-starter. I mean, across the spectrum.
Yeah, they're in terms of the two-state deal. Right. I don't think you have a Palestinian massive return.
Right.
What I tend to think, Dan, is there may have been a quick fix that was available in the 90s where you could kind of push all the 48 issues under the carpet and say, we're just here to address 67. And you could catch people enough by surprise, and the refugee community wouldn't have time to mobilize. And the settler community wasn't so large then and wouldn't have time to mobilize.
Yes.
The thing with a quick fix is you do it quickly, and we haven't done it quickly. And that's where my sense is that the quick fix is probably not possible anymore. So I think either Israel, which is terribly difficult, and I up front acknowledge that, would have to do more in order to get less. In other words, pull back much closer to 67, less land swaps, but not get an end of conflict, an end of claims, full peace in exchange for that. Or do a deal that addresses both 48 and 67. And I think that if Israel is able, from a position of, you know, we've done rather well as an Israeli state, I think we can be a lot more self-confident in the way we approach our own history and say, listen, you know, our circumstances at the time were appalling, unprecedented. And yes, we committed acts that we have to acknowledge. There needs to be a process of working through what we did, how we commemorate it, how we make good. That does not include people returning to homes that are no longer there, but that includes an honest accounting. And it also includes us acknowledging that the indigenous Palestinian Arab community that stayed in Israel and that today is a community of 20% of the Israeli population of over 1.5 million, has to be accorded full rights, has to be part of an inclusive, democratic Israel. And we acknowledge all those things. Like I say, terribly counterintuitive to the current Israeli
zeitgeist. I was going to say, I hate to say this, Daniel, you've just depressed the hell out of me, because I cannot see any scenario whereby a Israeli government would simultaneously agree to those terms and win an election.
Which is why I think probably the more realistic way to get there is, first of all, which is also not at all easy, to do the more for less. In other words, to do that 67 plus minus withdrawal border dispensation, but not to say we're only going to do it if this constitutes an end of conflict, an end of claims, and if a totally dismissive Israeli attitude to 48 is met by an absolute Palestinian acceptance of Israel, Jewish Israel, etc. The idea that the Lieberman-Netanyahu government can expect the Palestinians to embrace the Jewish state of Israel when they are helping to redefine that in such Israel in such undemocratic ways is a non-starter. Now, you know, I hope Israel, looking at its strategic environment, can say, you know, this isn't ideal, but there's a cutting of losses exercise to be undertaken here.
To what extent do you think? I mean, obviously, let's step back a little bit. We've been talking so from the Middle East perspective. We should talk about it, I suppose, from the U.S. perspective a little bit. There are two things that are going to be, one which happened previously and one which is about to happen this week. George Mitchell resigned as the Obama administration's Mideast peace envoy. This led to a lot of jokes on Twitter, which is something to the effect of, well, he effectively resigned 18 months ago because nothing else has been done. And that's fair enough. And then Obama is apparently going to be giving a major speech on U.S. policy in the Middle East on Thursday. If you were, you know, had the president's ear, what do you think he's going to say, and what do you think he should say?
I mean, just my understanding of the speech is that it will kind of be a Cairo to the president. I think is terribly good at articulating a big picture, empathetic American approach and understanding of the region. I think he tends to be shorn of some of the hubris that can characterize leaders. And I'd be, in the broader Middle East sense, expecting, I guess, not to go too granular on any particular country or issue, but to talk about that transition to full democracy, to talk about America respecting the direction the countries have gone in, maybe to own some of America's mistakes in the past by aligning itself too closely. Maybe that's expecting too much, aligning itself too closely with non-democratic regimes. I'm not expecting anything programmatic on Israel-Palestine. I think the American president will have to acknowledge just what a central issue this is. Yes, people were not out on the streets, initially at least, demonstrating against Israel or for the Palestinians during the Arab Spring wave. But it's very clear that part of the dignity deficit was lack of democracy, was lack of opportunity, but it was also an undignified foreign policy. I mean, in Egypt, the idea that Egypt is part of imposing a closure on Gaza is deeply undignified. And so that undignified foreign policy relates very centrally to Israel. And as every CENTCOM commander would tell you, not least Petraeus with his famous words in congressional testimony, this really matters to the U.S. So the president will have to address Israel-Palestine. What I hope he does in that context is be a friend to Israel, be a friend to the Palestinians, and do, I think, what would be right by America, which is be a bit more honest. I really think the Israeli side could do with a dose of honesty right now in terms of the predicament that they face. I think many on the in the Israeli mainstream are trying to be more realistic about the environment that they're in, and I think an indulgent business as usual approach is really falls short of the mark of what an American president could do right now. By being honest, I mean, look, there is a...
I was going to say, what would being honest mean in this case?
Well, I think there's an assumption across four administrations since the beginning of the 90s, across 20 years, of the direction all this is going in. that everybody knows what the two-state solution looks like mantra.
Right.
I think it would be fair for the president to say, I'm not going to clarify what that looks like. Other presidents and other documents have done that. Maybe it doesn't need to be clarified right now. But I need to know that you've bought into that. And if not, if you can't remove settlements, you couldn't freeze them, maybe you can't remove them. If that can't be done, let's have an honest conversation about the alternatives. Let's have an honest conversation about what it looks like to have Israeli communities beyond your border, whether the Palestinians would be willing to accept that. What would you give in return? Whether you can't actually divide the land. My understanding is Israelis do not want one binational democratic state. Given my commitment as the president to Israel, given my understanding of Jewish history, I can thoroughly understand the preference for a state of Israel. But let's be real. If we're going to continue with that way of going forward, there has to be a viable state of Palestine alongside you. You have to look with wide eyes, wide open eyes, at your alternatives. And let's not pretend that by not acting, by blaming the other side, and all the time by building more settlements, that we're doing ourselves any favors here. So that's the kind of you know, it doesn't mean laying out a programmatic plan. It doesn't mean threatening anything. It just means really speaking to Israelis about what their choices are. Because I think that conversation is beginning to happen in Israel. But the leadership continue to play this make-believe game. We're ready, of course we're ready for a two-state solution. No one wants peace more than us. It's just the other side. It's just the other side that's making it so difficult. Now, if Israel is really ready to do it, hand it over to the international community. If Israel's ready to get out of the territory, say, world, you step up. You have a mandate over these territories. We can't deal with the Palestinians. But we're willing to pull back. We're willing to pull back to 67, one-to-one, land swaps, etc. That's, I think, the urgency of the hour and what is needed. But I'd be interested in your take on it.
Well, I would say a few things. The first is, if I was advising Obama, I would say, I would offer, you know, a couple of thoughts. The first would be to stress that the road to democracy in the region, the sort of revolutions that took place in the streets of Cairo and Tunis, are the start and not the finish. Mm. And, you know, in fact, if I were him, I would probably draw on American history, among others, to point to the dangers of what happens or other examples, if you do not establish institutions and respect for the rule of law. Because in some ways, I am somewhat disturbed by how things are playing out in Egypt, and Egypt is in some ways the linchpin of how this plays out across the region. That would be the first thing. The second thing would be, I'm not sure if it would be programmatic, but at least to try to articulate an explanation for why the administration is intervening in some places but not others, just simply to acknowledge that there are certain facts of life, this is where honesty might actually be useful, although not terribly romantic, is say, look, our influence is limited. So the notion that a U.S. speech is going to influence anything in the region, it's worth pointing out the limits to us, to U.S. power. And then with respect to Israel and Palestine, I mean, in some ways you could tie that into the question about Palestine also developing the necessary democratic institutions. And that in some ways potentially at least alleviates or demonstrates to Israel that the U.S. is not just going to necessarily dismiss Israeli concerns. But with respect to Israel, you know, I like the honesty approach. My question is whether this administration is well placed to do that, because this administration is one of the most unpopular. It's the most unpopular, I think, in the post-Cold War era in Israel. And therefore, to what extent, even if Obama says these sorts of things, will it just fall on deaf ears?
I question whether that's the case. The Bush 1 administration, of course.
Bush 1, you're right, that's
the
fair.
The Ford administration announced a strategic review after Israeli foot-dragging on the disengagement.
Well, I said post-Cold War, so...
Post-Cold War, I'm sorry, I thought you said post-war. Yeah, yeah. I apologize.
No, post-Cold War.
and yet it's still the United States of America. And I agree. There's a consideration here to make of on balance, you know, does it get more dismissed or more listened to? I tend to think that given that you have to say something,
and I would add one more thing, which is this is also an administration that has made multiple missteps in dealing with the Netanyahu government in ways that actually I think sabotage the peace process. You know, for example, insisting on no new settlements. Which, you know, is an entirely justifiable goal, but it basically boxed the Palestinians into a situation where they had to insist on the exact same thing.
Look, where I have to differ on that is the peace process was finished. The mistake of this administration, I think, was basically to come in and say, we're smart diplomats. We can take the same ingredients but make a fabulous meal out of them. Rather than say, you know what, you don't have to just be smarter, because obviously any administration thinks we can do it better than the other folks.
Yeah.
You have to look at what's not worked here. I mean, the jury was in on the peace.
Yeah, oddly enough, I disagree with you. I mean, you're right that I think that was a mistake, but that actually wasn't the mistake. The mistake, which to be fair, I think the entire U.S. strategic community made, or a lot of them did, was the belief that the Israel-Palestinian issue was actually at the crux of the problems of the Middle East. And if there's anything that I think the Arab Spring has revealed, it's that that was not necessarily the case.
I think that's a straw man.
I don't think so.
I think the argument was and remains that the Israel-Palestine issue is central to everything else going on. I don't think anyone thought that if you solved Israel-Palestine, everything else magically falls into place. But I do think, and I think this continues to be the case, if as America, because America has a unique role in the Israel-Palestine issue, as America, if you line up on the wrong side of Palestinian freedom, if you're seen to be the great facilitator of Palestinian occupation, dispossession, whatever, that really puts a spanner in the works for anything else you might try and do. And I think we're seeing that. I think America's ability to navigate a path with an Egypt that has a more independent foreign policy could be overly circumscribed by the Israel piece of this. Whether it's taking a more deeper breath when it comes to the involvement of the Muslim Brotherhood in politics, or whether it's just... So anyway, I mean, you know, I think that...
I would push back a little bit. I say this after having read... I mean, I remember Obama's foreign affairs essay that he wrote in 2007 on the Middle East. And, you know, saying that everything revolved... You know, I think the central node, he really did think it was Israel-Palestine. And, no, you're off... I mean, obviously, he didn't think that if you solve that, everything else falls into place. But he thought that if you solved that or, you know, made headway on that, a lot of things fell into place. And I'm not sure that's the case anymore.
But I think there's a difference here that I think is important to draw out. And it's between the centrality of the issue in the region, and I think there it is central, but I also wouldn't too much overstate the case, and the centrality of the issue in terms of America's ability to interact with the region. Because I think
that's a fair... The U.S. has greater leverage on that issue compared to
And the U.S.
issues.
Is more trapped, but also the U.S. Yeah. If the U.S. can't solve this issue, and if the issue remains unresolved, and if America is so much seen through the prism of how it intervenes on this issue, being the one country that voted against a Security Council resolution on settlements, constantly carrying water, not for an Israel that's a reasonable ally, but carrying water for the Israeli occupation, seeming to carry water for... the ongoing Palestinian grievance narrative. That, you know, I think that's what so shrinks America's ability to get things done in the region. And I think that was a realization that, you know, as many people have adhered to for many years, if America could just say, listen, we're a great ally of Israel. Yeah, anything affecting Israel on the 67 lines, we're totally there for them. But we are going to distance ourselves a bit from the parts of Israeli behavior which contravene international law and just aren't helpful. But America can't do that. America finds itself going out to bat, even for settlements at the United Nations, by vetoing that resolution. And I think that's what's very constraining. That's what I think the distinction is.
This actually leads to an interesting way to close the conversation, which is correct me if I'm wrong, are you one of John Mearsheimer's righteous Jews? Were you on that list? I can't remember.
I don't think I made the list, Dan.
You didn't make the list? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
No.
But basically, it, whether or not the Arab Spring represents, you know, both you and I have written about the Israel lobby argument, I think you more sympathetically than me. But I think one of the interesting questions is whether or not the Arab Spring is, you know, as a sort of a data point, either supports or undercuts that argument. So do you think that the way in which the sort of American foreign policy community has responded to this demonstrates the power of the Israel lobby, the waning power of the Israel lobby, that nothing has changed, things like that?
Ask me next week after President Obama has spoken at spoken at AIPAC and after Netanyahu has addressed Congress. Let's see how reasonable the positions Netanyahu puts forward are, how they're received back home in Israel versus how they're received in Congress.
That was very artfully ducked. I think that's actually a nice way of closing, though. We will see how these things play out over the next week. Daniel, it was a pleasure to have this conversation.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Dan.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye.